the vital role palliative care plays in treating the individual and not just the disease. I'm Maeve McQuillan, and welcome to this 50 Faces Focus podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of people in medicine and science. I'm joined today by Dr. Alan Carver, who is an attending neurologist and palliative care physician at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Dr. Carver is also an associate professor of clinical neurology at the Weill Cornell Medical College. Thank you so much for joining me today, Alan.
My pleasure.
So what led you to study medicine?
Depends upon how much time you have. As an undergraduate student in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I studied history. And I thought I was going to be a high school teacher. And I was. There was a program at Harvard University to encourage Harvard graduates to become educators rather than Wall Streeters and other more common post-Harvard routes. And so I thought this was kind of exciting and interesting. So I participated in this program when I was an undergraduate through the Graduate School of Education. And when I graduated, I got my undergraduate degree, and I also got a certification to teach in what they called secondary school history in Massachusetts. And I did that for a couple of years, right after college. During that time, kids would come to see me after school for whatever it was. Usually it was an academic sort of question. Could you explain this a little further or whatever it was? And then being a little nosy and a little sort of curious, I'd find out a little bit about their lives and a little bit about what it was like to be a teenager, high school student. And I remember I would go home some days thinking, I really enjoyed that one-on-one interaction even more. Although I like teaching and I still teach as part of what I do, I really began to think that that was actually the crux of what I like to do most. So after a couple of years, I made a little switch and I got a job doing some research in the Department of Psychiatry at Mass General in Boston. And then it sort of crystallized for me that what I really wanted to do was go to med school. I went to medical school principally to become a psychiatrist because I was interested in the kids and I was interested in mental health. And then I got turned on by the brain. I had a professor who said, what's most fascinating about the brain is that when the brain changes, the person changes. And that you can study the liver, you can study the lungs, you can study the heart, and it's the same person with those organs that get sick. When the brain gets sick, the entire individual takes a turn. Some of it's an irretrievable turn, sometimes increasingly, that's the optimistic side, there are turns that are reversible. But nonetheless, there's a profound nature to the idea of brain disease, brain injury, that I just found to be endlessly fascinating.
So when you became interested in the brain, you realized that psychiatry, even though that would deal with the brain, was not for you.
Yeah, I had an idea at one point. There was a possibility. There are some places in the United States where you can do, and maybe even in Europe as well, where you can do dual residencies and you can actually become certified in both. But then I began to look into that more and began to understand that what a psychiatrist does every day for a living and what a neurologist does every day are really very different things. And both are very humbling. Both are challenging. Both would take and are taking a lifetime to actually develop some degree of competency and expertise. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to actually make some sort of contribution here, I better make a choice. But I never, it's interesting though that you mention it because, as you say, they're certainly linked. Freud was both a neurologist and a psychiatrist and understood that there's a lot of linkage between the two. And in many patients who I see, certainly at Sloan Kettering, where I see lots of patients who have cancer as it affects the brain, there is a fairly hefty emotional component. And so I find that my interest in the emotional aspects of disease, without being a psychiatrist in name, is very well satisfied. Because while I have colleagues in the field who they're very interested in neurology, and if someone cries, they're very happy to send them to a colleague in psychiatry. that's just not me. I mean, it's not me, it's not who I am, and it's not part of what motivates me to do this.
What led you to specialize in palliative care?
So by happenstance, and it really is actually by, I mean, I didn't go to Cornell particularly for this, but when I went to Cornell, I started to do these various, what are called rotations across the street at Sloan Kettering. And I began to see pretty sick patients, many of whom had, this is now mid-90s, many of whom had limited life prognoses, who had come to Sloan Kettering because it's a world-famous institution and there's a tremendous amount of hope riding on that admission or that consultation. And then now they're being told, sometimes their hope is being gratified, and sometimes they're very sick and they're being told something that they were told in three other places, which is death is not far off. And what we need to do is to do right by you and to do right by your family is to help you to live, as we like to say, as well as you can for as long as you can. And I began to see at MSK that it's sort of a very interesting kind of duality that's walked there. Because, as I say, on the one hand, there's no better place to be in terms of how the field of oncology has advanced in the last 20 years, 25 years, is so extraordinary. All of us have patients who are alive now, some, many of whom actually are cancer-free, including people who have disease of the brain, that we know 20 years ago they would have died, but because of the advances in the field are now cancer-free. So on the one hand, it's an incredibly exciting time to work in the world of cancer. That's on the one side. On the other side, and this is the side you won't necessarily hear about in the ad campaigns, but on the other side, people die there and people die at home. And there is an extraordinary, potent, and I think vital opportunity to meet the very, very complex needs of patients and families who aren't going to make it long, but nonetheless are in need of expertise in what to do, what to say, how to say it. And this is where the whole world of palliative care sort of comes into being. Mm-hmm. I met when I got to MSK, my mentor, this woman by the name of Dr. Kathy Foley. She's retired now, but she was a neurologist. She came there in the late 1970s, also a graduate of the Cornell program. And she looked around and she said, looks like there are a lot of people here in pain, because cancer causes pain in an awful lot of patients, including patients with advanced disease in particular, and no one seems to know what to do. And she was a pioneer. In the United States, she started the first pain service focused upon cancer pain. And she became my principal mentor. And when I came there as a resident, we published a paper together. Then some other stuff followed. And basically, I'm sort of following, I owe my career to her, because largely she's the person who inspired me to do the work that I'm doing, and to try to say that our obligation to these patients is to meet these needs. Treating the cancer is just simply not sufficient. You have to treat the person with the cancer, whatever that may mean to the individual.
But I think for a lot of people, when they think about palliative care, they think of hospice, but it's so much more than hospice.
They're very different. A lot of time I spend is in, sometimes we call it myth busting. Sometimes we call it just in redefinition. There are various definitions out there of palliative care. Hospice is only one element of it.
Yeah.
One that I like is a short one, but I've always liked it. The World Health Organization years ago said palliative care is the active total care of patients whose disease is not responsive to curative treatment.
Okay.
Right. So what I like about the definition is that it emphasizes the word active.
Yeah.
So that's one thing, because I have an Oxford textbook of palliative medicine in my office that's 1,100 pages. So it emphasizes the idea that palliative care isn't about the doctor going away. Isn't about the doctor stepping back and saying, well, it's time for palliative care. It's actually about saying, no, this maybe a shift in the goals of the care, but nonetheless, the care is going to be very active, and here's what we're going to do. So I kind of liked it just because it's sort of, I like the focus. We think that a lot of, some of the reasons why patients are afraid of palliative care, as you said, is they think about hospice. And the other thing is that they think that we're going to be abandoned. I have patients who tell me that, oh, Dr. Carver, if I have hospice care at home, does that mean we won't talk anymore?
Yeah.
If I'm on hospice, are you gone? You know,
yeah.
It becomes very important for me to say, no, we're going to keep having appointments. We're going to be, of course, this is what I think would be helpful for you to take care of what you need, but it doesn't mean I'm going away.
Yeah. And that's where the active part comes in, what you're talking about.
Right. Yeah. And the physician non-abandonment part. I may suggest to a patient that I think it would be good to have our palliative care team involved. And a very common response I'll get is, you think I'm on my way out, huh, doctor? You know, and often the response will be, no, I actually think you'll live longer with palliative care. We have data for that, by the way. There's good data for the fact that if you involve in patients with metastatic cancer, if you take two groups and you give one group chemotherapy and palliative care, and you give the other group chemotherapy and not palliative care, the group that you give palliative care, they live longer. Because for all the sort of reasons that you might surmise, palliative care is good for one's health. If you pay attention to symptom control and you pay attention to quality of life, it tends to be that the heart rate goes down a bit and the blood pressure goes down a bit and the stress level goes down a bit and the spirit rises a bit and people feel listened to. It's an enormous difference. And it's, of course, it's not only about longevity, but it's about, depends upon how we measure our time. Do we measure it based upon number of days or do we measure it upon how those days are lived? Sometimes I'm able to succeed with families and say, listen, I'm recommending this because yes, we're at a point where the disease is at a serious crossroads. I know that you all want to have as much time as you can with one another. And this is the best way that I know to help to make that happen. And if we continue with the chemotherapy alone, we've seen people die sooner because it's toxic. And people get sick and they get fevers and they end up in the hospital more and then they get an infection and then this and that and they actually die sooner. And so it depends upon, we always talk about the goals of care. You know, it really depends upon the goals of care. For some families, interestingly, some people have thought us crazy for this, but there are families for whom it is actually important to have the chemo running in to the vein on the day that the patient dies. Sounds insane, I know, to many people. But for some families and for some patients, there is something about that. It celebrates life in some way. And sometimes that needs to be respected, even if everybody in the room knows that actually it's not going to make a meaningful difference against the disease. It becomes not about the disease. It becomes about the patient.
Do you find that the family, the involvement of the family is really helpful?
Well, as a neurologist, I'll tell you this, in terms of brain disease, one of many reasons why we think it's so important to think about some of these palliative care, quality of life issues, which includes advanced directives, understanding what patients' wishes are early on, is because of what we talked about at the start of this conversation, that when I see a patient early on, the patient's all there. And the first obligation of the physician is to the patient, not to the family. But when the brain changes and the patient becomes either confused or comatose or whatever it is, and there are decisions to be made, then we turn to the proxy, typically, because we can't talk to the patient anymore.
That makes
sense. So ideally, it's hard. It's very hard sometimes. Someone comes to a place like MSK really hoping that we're going to provide the cure that nobody else can. And if you start talking about palliative care on the first visit, you're probably not going to see them again, right? So I find that it's the timing, I think, is challenging. But I find that relative, if I see someone, however, who I know from what we know about their disease, that it would be extremely unlikely for them to survive this disease, then relatively early on, maybe it's not the first visit, maybe it's the second or the third, when I'm getting to know them, I'm going to start to talk with them about some of these issues. So that way, when they come to the hospital 3 months later, no one's surprised.
Yeah.
Can be very gratifying. We've had patients who, he was in his 50s and he had a bad brain tumor and was expected to live a year and a half, except another year and a half. In 3 years, his daughter was getting married. And as I got to know him, I sat down with them and I said, what do you think about the date of the wedding? And they looked at me and they said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I said, I see that you're close. I see that it's close family and so on and so forth. And they start crying. And I said, you know, if it's important, you know, you have a serious tumor and you're doing well right now, and maybe you'll be there in 3 years, but statistically, maybe you won't. And if it's important for you to walk your daughter down the aisle, you might want to. There are options that we help people with in this situation. They were enormously grateful for the conversation and said that it just had never occurred to them, because this was now a year into the disease.
Mm-hmm.
The man was still working. He was doing well.
Yeah.
But it just had never occurred to them, probably a healthy amount of denial going on there, that he wouldn't be there 2 years later. But it meant a lot. So I find those are the kinds of opportunities that if we can take them, it can be satisfying. Sad, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But also for this family, it makes all the difference in the world. The father will not survive long term, but they're going to have photos of that wedding that will.
Yeah, of course. So it sounds like, I'm really impressed by the fact that with the palliative care, it sounds like there is also creates a room for openness and a trust and an honesty to build between the patient, the family, and the doctor that maybe that isn't allowed if it's just straightforward oncology.
It's interesting. I mean, when I was in training in palliative medicine, we used to joke about the fact that one of our goals was to make ourselves obsolete so that the oncologists would know palliative medicine so well that they wouldn't need it. First of all, that hasn't happened. Second of all, I would just tell you that there is, in oncology, we see a range. We see a range. We see people in oncology who absolutely they have these conversations and they really don't need us.
Mm-hmm.
The palliative care people make a distinction between primary palliative care and specialist palliative care. And what they say is that primary palliative care should be part of the competency set of every oncologist. Every oncologist should know how to give bad news.
So that basic. So it's just to help,
yeah,
to help with the communication.
If someone had an MRI scan and the disease got worse and you're having a meeting with the family and the family says, because one of the many stressors of the cancer patients live with is, they talk about it, they write about it, is they live from picture to picture.
Yeah.
And if it's not good news, so how do you say that?
Mm-hmm.
What do you say? What don't you say? How do you listen? We believe you don't have to be born with this, which is what people used to think, you know, a long time ago. These are teachable skills. Now, whether if someone has pain in multiple places and they're on three different drugs and they're hallucinating and they have an itch and so on, and the oncologist is really like, oh my God, what do I do? That would be called secondary specialist palliative care.
Okay.
You know, so I think that there's a distinction between what patients ought to expect. And Kathy used to talk about this, that raising the bar of expectation among our patients, so that patients shouldn't go to an oncologist and just expect chemotherapy.
Mm.
Patients should go to an oncologist and actually also expect compassion.
Yeah.
They should expect competence and not arrogance.
Well, absolutely. But then that sounds like that's something that actually has to be part of the education.
Absolutely.
Of all doctors, because I would say even you move outside of oncology, you still need palliative care for all sorts of illnesses, right? So it sounds like palliative care is an approach that needs to be integrated with all areas of medicine.
And the hopeful news is that I can tell you that there is more attention in medical schools, certainly across the United States, than ever before. I can tell you that. I can tell you that many medical schools have a teaching lab for communication. We have one in which we employ actors from New York City theater circles.
They're probably pretty good then.
They are indeed. We give them script. We've written these various scenarios, and they play the angry patient. They play the patient who's getting the bad news, or the family member who's very disappointed, whatever it is. And then we film trainees. And then we watch them together, and we talk, and we give them feedback. And it's great stuff. It's great stuff. But we're not, I mean, we're not at all, MSK is not, you know, it's being done at several places around the country. So there are a lot of hopeful signs.
That's good.
In terms of our recognizing that this is not necessarily an option. And I keep quoting Kathy, but I'll give you one more, which is to say that this is something she wrote in the New England Journal a number of years ago. She said, you know, I'm not talking about handholding. This is not about compassion. This is about competence.
This
is about what does it mean to be a doctor?
I know that you also have been doing annual conferences in Salzburg where you're also focusing on this as well.
Right. It's actually biannual. I'd love it to be annual. I hope it'll be annual. At the moment, it's biannual.
Okay.
It all depends on their schedule. It's been every other year. And yes, it's an MSK faculty. We invite neurologists and neuro-oncologists and palliative care people, hospice people, primarily from Eastern European countries to come for a week of training, education in all of these areas. It's enormously gratifying. Most of these folks have not had a whole lot of training in these areas, although we can usually identify some champions, which is kind of exciting in each of these groups, but it's gratifying to kind of bring them up to speed. It's gratifying to feel their interest and support and to feel like they're change makers. I mean, part of the purpose of the course is to present essential competencies for neurologists and neuro-oncologists in palliative care medicine. Mm-hmm. That's sort of goal number one. Goal number two is really equally important, which is to sort of provide them with the tools to go back to their countries to be their local champions. Because the laws won't change unless they do.
And have they seen improvements in their countries?
Country by country.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had, this was well before the Ukraine war, but it's a good story. We had a number of years ago in Ukraine, there was a law that said that no one could receive more than 50 milligrams of morphine 4 times a day. And we had a patient who was at home with cancer that we came to know about. And first of all, there was no way, I mean, it has to be delivered by a nurse. And of course, what nurse can come 4 times a day? So that didn't make any sense. Also, the number didn't make any sense. The thing about opioids is that the number isn't what matters so much when you're dealing with pain control. What matters is the impact and the side effects. And if it helps, that's great. But if it doesn't help, then you give more and you follow it until you get either the response that you want, or you run into a problem with side effects and you do something else. But the Ukraine laws were devoid of any of this kind of sophistication. It was just 50 milligrams 4 times a day. That's all you could do. So we found out about this, my group found out about this, and basically they started a whole public ad campaign. This young man's name was Vlad, and posters went up all over Kyiv and other places of Vlad suffering at home. And what was interesting was the discovery that was made was that the officials in the government, they weren't actually, aside from there was a little bit of opioid phobia, a little bit of you know, well, you know, morphine and substance abuse and whatever. But it wasn't even so much that. It was really that, like, it was somewhat arbitrary. Like, they, like, it was in the books, it's 54 times a day. Like, that's what people need. But it wasn't really like, once they really didn't have a problem with making a change, but we had to do it, you know, and we had to advocate for it. And we, when I say we, it was the people in our group who were from Ukraine, who went back and said, look, this doesn't make any sense, so on and so forth. And it changed.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a very exciting story. So that's one great success story. So that's part of the mission of the Salzburg program, is to have stuff like that happen.
I know you've mentioned one of your main influences was your professor, Kathy yes. Foley. Is that?
Yes.
Yeah. Were there any other people in your through your studies or your career that have influenced you?
Yeah, of course. Thank you. Yeah. The creator of the field of neuro-oncology, his name was Dr. Jerry Posner. Before Jerry came to Sloan Kettering in 1968 from the University of Washington. Before Jerry, there was no neuro-oncology. There was medical oncology, and medical oncologists care of brain tumor patients. And Jerry was a neurologist, and Jerry thought it's probably a subspecialty area of knowledge that we ought to understand more about patients with brain tumors. And so he truly launched this whole field. And he's a brilliant, brilliant man. And I had the privilege of working with him and training with him. And his disciple was Lisa DeAngelis. Lisa DeAngelis is now, she was my chair in the Department of Neurology until a few years ago, when she became the physician in chief of the entire hospital. Those three, I always feel like some three. I mean, they're like three of the leading lights in medicine and in neurology in the last 100 years. And they happen to be the three most influential people in terms of my career. I mean, I really feel like they taught me everything that I know.
That's amazing.
Everything that I know, everything I watch, and as you know, in this field, as in others, it's all about mentorship. You know?
Yeah.
It's just all about that.
If there was something, if you could sort of give any advice to your younger self, what would it be?
It's a dangerous question. The very younger self.
Yes.
Medicine has changed a great deal. So famously, President Kennedy was asked in one of his televised press conferences, do you like your job and do you recommend it to others? He answered, yes and no.
Okay.
And everybody sort of laughed a little bit. And I think that for me is very much the point. I have no regrets. You're hearing over the course of this conversation that I have a lot of interest in these areas. I have passion in these areas. I have a sort of a whole life or a whole adult life anyway. Maybe goes back further. Of commitment to being concerned about people with brain disease. We didn't talk about my brother, but my brother has impairments that are referable to the brain that I am certain inspired some of this work. By the same token, medicine is not only a very costly road. I mean, it's costly in so many ways. It's costly financially. It's costly emotionally. Doctors a generation ago used to be, they would always, of course I'd recommend it to my children.
Mm.
Of course, it's a wonderful profession. My children, my grandchildren. And there's absolutely no way I'd feel that way, honestly. I can recommend the benefits of it.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is something else, if Esme, my daughter, were to be a psychologist and get some of the same rewards without some of this baloney, it would be a downer to get into the, what do they call it? The industrialization of medicine and the corporatization of medicine.
Mm.
And the increasing sense that you are, in fact, working for as much for AT&T as for anybody. It detracts from the mission.
Yeah.
So I'm looking increasingly towards figuring out there's enough. It's a great place to be. It's a good perch, you know, because it gives me an opportunity to meet extraordinary people, tremendously interesting, compelling patients, and to do the work that I want to do. You know,
Yeah. That's
a little bit off topic of your question, what to say early. I don't know that I would have necessarily done anything different, really, personally.
Yeah.
It's just hard to endorse it to a high school student.
No.
Who's interested in medicine. It's very hard to do that, given the fact that this is not the profession of before.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh my God, babe, thank you.
This has been so great. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Oh, it's wonderful. I feel like you've really, you know, really given me a deeper understanding of what you do, of what palliative care is, and the importance of it, and the whole idea of patients' rights also, and the whole idea of what a competent doctor is. It's all been really, really fascinating and lots of food for thought. So thank you.
A pleasure.
I'm Maeve McQuillan. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces Focus podcast. If you like what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring people in their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.